The older I get, the more I've realized how much time I have to set aside just to clean. I'll ask a friend, "What'd you get up to last weekend?" And they'll think for a bit and then say, "I just cleaned." Crap, I gotta do that too. I've seen people, therapists, and the elderly all talk about how everyone's too gosh darn connected to their cell phones. How we don't allow ourselves a single moment to be present or alone with our thoughts. But when it comes to cleaning, I think you should fill that void up with as much noise as possible. Cleaning is such a boring and monotonous task that even people in the 1700s would pass the time by singing to themselves. And while these pilgrims didn't have endless podcasts to listen to, you have YouTube videos. Like this one. So I want this video to serve as the noise you listen to while you get up and clean something. Hopefully hearing a YouTuber talk about cleaning for the next 10 minutes will motivate you to start chipping away at that mess you've been putting off for months. I'm not asking you to drop everything and do a 3-hour deep clean of your closet, but half-assing something is still better than no-assing something. And I think you'd be surprised with how nice you can make a space look in only 10 minutes. I want to give the caveat that I'm not a clean freak. I've lived in a college dorm with a bunch of other guys. My sink is most likely full of dishes as you're watching this. And if anyone needs to do a 3-hour deep clean of their closet, it's me. And I also know how hard it can be to look at a room that's in such a bleak and disarray state that you get so overwhelmed by the mess that you don't even know where to start cleaning. So you never do, which perpetuates this never-ending cycle that makes your entire space and mental health messier. Luckily, I have a solution. If you don't even know where to begin dealing with the mess, the first step to cleaning any room is taking out the trash. That's it. That's all you have to do. All those empty bottles and boxes, get them out of there. Whenever I clean, I like to play this fun little game that I know you've never played before because it's a game I invented. It's called... Is that where that goes? To play this game, all you have to do is point at an object and go... Is that where that goes? And if that object is where it goes, then you're good. You don't have to do anything. But if that object isn't where it goes, then you put it where it goes. And you beat the game once everything that's going to or needed to go goes where it goes. So while you're grabbing trash bags and flattening out boxes, let me explain why I found cleaning to be so important in my adult life. I really have to thank my parents for distilling, I wouldn't call it a love for cleaning, but rather a tolerance for it. Growing up, my parents would print out physical job charts for the week, and every day us kids did all of our chores, we would earn $1. However, any single chore we didn't do, we would lose $1. Meaning, it was possible for us to come out of a week of doing chores in the red. My parents were earning money and teaching us about capitalism because my bed wasn't made. Still owe them 35 bucks. We were able to earn some money back doing Saturday chores. This is when we did a deeper clean like vacuuming or mopping. But Saturday chores didn't even hold a candle to the absolute worst chores we had to do, which were the dreaded... Company is coming over chores. For some reason, whenever company was on their merry way, it was vital that rooms said company would never even enter in the first place were spotless. This one time, I think my mom was hosting like book club or something, I finished mopping my bathroom, which was not a bathroom that anyone in book club would be using, by the way, and my mom did her usual room cleanliness inspection and said, "I think you should wipe that bucket down too." She was making us clean the cleaning instruments. Do you want me to vacuum the vacuum next? However, if it wasn't for all those chores my parents forced me to do, I feel like cleaning would have become something I dreaded doing, instead of something I can actually wind down the day with. I look forward to folding laundry and putting something on the TV because I feel like I did something productive while watching cartoons. And since I don't live with mom anymore, I don't have to clean my bucket, which now doubles as a toilet. Cleaning has become such an integral part of my life that cleaning other people's spaces is how I show my affection. I'm about to put one of my best friends on complete blast here, but I think he'll be okay with it because he constantly asks me to put him in videos. I'm doing a video that's a puppet show with two bricks.
Can I voice one of the bricks?
Okay. I recently visited one of my close friends, Infamous Swoosh, at his place in upstate New York. He's 24, living on his own for the first time with three other dudes, and the second I stepped into his house, I went, oh, this is a guy's house. I don't think a woman's been in here in, like, ever. What really sealed it for me was the bathroom not having a trash can, but rather a loose trash bag leaning up against a wall. And it was full. I hadn't planned for this to be on the itinerary of my New York trip, but after seeing how dire Swoosh's living conditions were, I decided to take him to his local Target to get him some necessary supplies. I originally set out to get him three things: a trash can, trash bags, and a handheld vacuum. But as we were walking through Target, we passed the broom aisle, and I asked, "You have a broom, right?" And his shoulders started to slowly rise into a shrug, and I went, "Dude!" Then we passed the Brita filter aisle, and I said, "You have one of these, right? You haven't just been drinking tap water this whole time, right?"
I mean, the sink's right there.
You know, Swoosh, normally when people move into a new place, they do a big Target run to get all the necessary cleaning supplies for their house.
What do you mean? I did do a Target run. Didn't you see that buffalo painting in my office?
Up until this point, Swoosh had been drying all of his dishes with paper towels, which I guess is good because I just assumed he was eating everything in his bare hands like a Neanderthal, so I think I'm saving him money in the long run. I'm really about to show my age here, but since I'm doing a whole video about cleaning, I just need to gush real quick about my favorite piece of cleaning equipment. This was one of the original three items I set out to get Swoosh before I knew how dire his situation was. This is completely unsponsored, by the way, but the Bissell Pet Hair Eraser Hand Vacuum has divided my life into two moments: the time spent before I had this vacuum, and the time spent after. I love this vacuum so much that I've gifted it to friends on three separate occasions. Now, this next piece of advice I used to roll my eyes at, but after I started doing it, I've really been enjoying it. And that is to make your bed first thing in the morning. I used to think, why do I need to make my bed? I'm just gonna get it messy again. But making your bed is having the first thing you do in the morning be something that benefits your future self. It helps set the tone for the day. And if you are able to complete that small task, then you're probably more likely to complete other more important tasks. No, making my bed didn't magically fix all my problems, but no matter what kind of day I was having, it was always nice ending it in a clean bed. Obviously, there's more to life than cleaning. I would know. I own all the Warrior Cat books. But I think everyone should enjoy the space they live in. I feel like a lot of us fall into a bad habit of dreading to do a task longer than it would take for us to just do said task. I definitely can be like that sometimes, but if you've been following along and been cleaning while this video played in the background, while your room might not be completely spotless, I hope you can see how much of a difference you made in only 10 minutes. Now imagine how much you can do in 20 minutes. Isn't cleaning while watching YouTube videos so fun? Isn't doing tasks so accomplishing? So if you need to clean, go clean! Go clean your bedroom! Go clean your kitchen! Unclog that toilet! The world is your oyster! Get out there and clean!
Mr. James, on Saturday morning at 10:03 a.m., you were observed coloring a picture of a dinosaur. Is that true?
Yeah. Can we go to recess?
Even though your mom had repeatedly asked you to clean up your toys, you disobeyed her and colored anyway?
I plead the fifth.
Your Honor, I have no further questions. James, I hereby sentence you to 15 minutes in the timeout corner.
I'm not going back to timeout!
I'm no scientist, but I think moms play a very important role in society. Without moms, who would drive us to soccer practice? Who else would tell us that it's not okay to eat cupcakes for breakfast? And who else would point at construction workers and say, "That's why you need to get a college education, James"? Oh, and I guess they also give birth to you and take care of you, but like, anyone could do that. Now, before I talk about how I was raised, I just want to give out this disclaimer that my mom is a great mom. She loves me, at least she used to, If you asked me when I was 15 if my mom was a good mom, 15-year-old me would have said, no. Okay, but like, when I was little, I'd be talking with my friends, and we would be talking about our parents, and they would say stuff like, yeah, my mom lets me stay up till midnight, and she lets me play really graphic and vulgar video games. Yeah, my mom doesn't care if I wear clothes with skulls on them, and she lets me eat an entire tub of ice cream for dinner. My mom lets me play with knives. And I used to think that their moms were so much cooler for letting my friends have that much fun. But now, as an adult, I realize the sad truth, that these kids' moms weren't cooler. They just cared about them less. I'm not saying every mom out there is perfect, but a mom who takes the time to make a responsible member of society is pretty high up on the good mom list. Anyways, I love you, Mom, and now I'll immortalize and monetize some of that love. When I was younger and still in need of adult supervision, my mom would take me and my twin sister out to run errands with her. And, as you would expect, we were rowdy and wanted to do our own thing. But my mom was prepared for this. She would bring 2 plastic baggies filled with 10 M&Ms, and every time my sister or I misbehaved, she would eat an M&M right in front of us. And she made sure we saw her eat our M&Ms. She didn't give us a warning, either. If we did anything remotely bad, she would say, hey, hey, look at me. And I think that parenting technique is the psychological reason that M&Ms are my favorite candy bar.
I'm a good boy. I'm a good boy.
Something me and my sister really liked doing was hiding in those circular racks of clothes that they have set up in department stores. Being in the middle of one of those racks is such a surreal experience. I totally recommend it. But my mom didn't like it when we had fun, so she had to reach her arm in and try and grab us. Do you need any help? Oh, no, I'm just trying to get something in the back. There's a really nice belt that would be great for spanking my misbehaving children! I was spanked as a kid. Nothing too bad. I probably deserved it anyway. I don't remember any specific actions I did that earned a spanking, but I do remember outrunning my mom a lot. Another thing my mom did when I was very little was sometimes when she was washing her hands, she would turn to me and go, achoo, and flick water in my face. It really bothered me, but I never spoke out about it. And one day I just couldn't handle it anymore and I started crying. Why are you crying? But I was too sad to articulate how I was really feeling. If you ask her about this today, she'll say that she doesn't remember doing that sneeze gag ever, but I remember it. Vividly. So to get back at her, I put a rubber band around the dish sprayer, so when you turn on the sink, it would spray water at you. Come to think of it, I do remember one reason I was spanked. Every time one of my siblings insulted another sibling or told them to shut up, we would have to pay them 50 cents. This resulted in a really weird dynamic when it came to insults. We would get excited when someone called us a name.
Mom, Luke called me a butthole!
That's 50 cents!
Woo! I'm rich!
But sometimes, us kids would just be messing around with each other and we didn't really mean the insults. So we would feel bad taking someone else's 50 cents. Like someone would say, hey, James, what's 6 plus 6? And I would say, 9, idiot. And my mom would hear me and say, James, that's 50 cents. And my sister would feel bad, so she would insult me back and say, James, you're an unpleasant person. Aw. Swear words cost you $5. That's why I don't swear in videos. But now I can afford it. So, f*** you, Mom. You piece of f***. My mom never washed her mouths out with soap, she wasn't that kind of person, but she did threaten to if we swore. And one time after I said a pretty naughty word, penis, she said, if you don't behave, I'm going to get the soap. And I said, I don't care, soap tastes good. All right, you big dingus, shove this in your mouth, you won't do it, no balls. So I bit into it and immediately regretted it. Now people are eating soap for views. So I guess we never grow up. Did anyone else's parents put a password on the family computer? Because my parents did, and I didn't know we were the only family that did that. We had a rule in the house that we were only allowed to be on the family computer for however long we read a book for. But luckily, I would just read a book for 15 minutes, get my mom to type in the password, and then she would just forget that I was on the computer and let me stay on for hours. And I played a lot of Neopets and RuneScape. Also, I wasn't allowed to have a TV or a computer in my room, because then I would have easy access to inappropriate animes. When I was little, cell phones were a thing, but my mom didn't let me have one, so I had to talk to all my friends over a landline. I hope I don't have to explain what that is, because that would make me feel really old, and I'm supposed to be in the prime of my life. But basically it meant if I was upstairs in my room talking to a friend, my mom could grab a phone downstairs in the kitchen and just join in our conversation completely uninvited. It didn't matter who I was talking to, I'd be having a conversation like this. I think the reason I internalize and hide away all my problems is because of how invasive my mom is in my personal life.
James, get off the phone and do the dishes.
Mom, I'm on the phone!
Wow, I can't believe said that to the person who gave birth to you. So what are you two losers talking about?
Luckily, I would almost never be talking to a girl. So at least that didn't happen. This other time, my mom was giving me and my sister a ride to school, and on the radio, she was listening to the worst subgenre of rock music. Christian rock?
Just kidding, you can like whatever you want.
Anyway, we were pulling up to the school, and I told my mom to turn the music down. What? Why? Because I don't want people to think I listen to this, Mom. You see, I was in junior high, so I cared a lot about what other people cared about. So she turned the music down, but as we stepped out of the car, she turned the volume all the way back up and blasted the music for everyone to hear. Looking back at the situation, I think that's pretty hilarious. GG, Mom. These aren't all the times my mom embarrassed me, but those are all the ones I'm going to include in this video. I didn't even mention the time when I was 4 when my twin sister wanted to do ballet lessons, but she didn't want to do them alone, so my mom signed me up for lessons too. But that's a story for another video. Love you, Mom. You made me like this.
This brick is alive. Not convinced? Well, what if I did this?
I'm gonna do a backflip!
That's gonna look so cool, Brickathy!
What are you boys doing?
Brickathy's gonna do a backflip, Grandma!
Are you convinced now? Did the brick feel more alive? I mean, sure, it's still a brick that can't move on its own, but maybe because I put googly eyes on it and gave it a family, you can connect with this brick, and it made you feel emotions. Convincing you that something inanimate is animate is the main goal of the animate ore. They're nothing more than deranged frauds. For the last century, animators have innovated new techniques and styles to this medium, taking it from a spinning wheel that doesn't even use electricity to Spider-Verse. And today, I'm going to talk about all the processes and innovations that have brought the medium of animation to right now. But first, let's go all the way back to the beginning of film, when it was all black and white and people had to put up text whenever they talked. Early on, filmmakers discovered a very simple trick to make anything appear alive in front of a camera. And that simple trick was called... You're filming something, and then stop the camera, and then move the thing slightly, capture a new image, move the thing again, and continue to do that a tedious amount of times. On the film, that thing now magically looked like it move on its own. And with this technique, you could make literally anything appear to be moving. Anything. But some filmmakers took this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters out of clay and a posable metal wire system called an armature. Now, animators can sculpt unique characters that bend and pose in much more believable ways. With stop motion, you don't need to hire a real dinosaur or giant monkey to make a movie about a dinosaur or giant monkey. I'm sorry you didn't get the job, Phil. You know, I just had a crazy idea. What if we made our entire puppet's head interchangeable? Now they can make any facial expression and mouth shape possible. We will have to sculpt out hundreds of different heads, though, but, I mean, come on, that'll be fun. That's why we're extreme, baby! Stop-motion movies are still being made and enjoyed to this day. And while new technology does help make the overall process easier, animators are still using the same techniques that were used on King Kong back in the 1920s, where they carefully pose out a character's every movement frame by frame. In order. Stop motion is a medium that I can't even begin to understand how they do, let alone make it look good, you know? Having a stop motion character in gravity-defying poses, making hundreds of different faces, is done solely to make the character feel more alive. And sometimes, to help sell the realism, animators will mimic quirks that only happen in live-action films. I always chuckle when I see a lens flare in an animated movie, because, like, where did you come from? There's not even a camera lens. Unlike me, though, who's always got a camera rolling. Hey, how's it going? Uh-oh. Oh, no! Did you catch that? Did you see the lizard eating a bug? Ooh, we got him. Now let's rewind the clip and pause right here.
This lizard moves so fast that the camera can't even capture its movements correctly, and he transmogrifies into an amorphic blob that barely even resembles a lizard. But do not fret, dear viewer. This is called motion blur, and is absolutely natural. Fast-moving objects are hard to see in real life anyway, so this blurry blob only showing up for one frame actually helps sell the idea that this little guy is moving quickly. If you watch any movie frame by frame, you'll find motion blur everywhere, and you won't even notice. So how do animators who are taking hundreds of still photos handle this naturally occurring phenomenon with things in motion? Easy, they'll draw smear. Animators draw their own blurry blob frame to mimic fast movements. Bodies can stretch, arms can multiply, basically we can sneak in nightmares as long as it's only shown for one frame. Smears, while being very fun to draw, can look very weird and goofy on their own. But in the context of the whole shot, you barely even notice they're there. Okay, maybe now you'll notice them, but that's only because I pointed them out. And since animators are bad boys and don't play by the rules, they can make smears out of anything. Even in stop motion, we can sculpt a physical smear frame like how they did in Laika's Paranorman, which, if you haven't seen, is going to be your new favorite movie. Smear frames can be used anytime, anywhere. Unless you were an animator in the 1920s and 30s and you didn't know about them back then. In that case, you would have been animating something called... In the 1920s and 30s, animators were still figuring out some core principles of animation. Turns out there's 12 of them. Smear frames were used sparingly during this time, with animators usually only drawing characters with multiple limbs to show fast movements. The stretchy, wacky, and spiritually ascending smears that you all know and love weren't really used until the 1940s. Rubber hose characters have noodly, almost hose-like limbs that bend in all sorts of anatomically defying ways. Look at Mickey Mouse's noodle arms that I can now legally show you. The reason characters look like this is because drawing noodle arms and not worrying about anatomy is easier to draw. But like, just because something has noodle arms doesn't mean it's bad, you guys. What these animators were able to accomplish with the technology, if you could even call it that, is nothing short of dark magic. And the very same studio that made Steamboat Willie wanted to push the envelope and show the world that animation could be more. It doesn't just have to be noodly characters with Pac-Man eyes. They were going to animate a realistic woman with proportional arms that don't move in weird, exaggerated ways. And oh god, her noodle arms are moving in weird, exaggerated ways. In 1934, Disney released a short called The Goddess of Spring, being their first attempt at animating a character with what was supposed to have real human anatomy. They still had a lot to learn, obviously. Now, animating a quote-unquote anatomically correct human is actually a much harder task than you might realize, and that's because of the uncanny valley. Get more and more human characteristics, we hit an interesting point right here when something looks almost like a human, but is just a little off. Our pattern recognition brains start setting off alarm bells and go, ugh, something is definitely wrong with that almost human. I am entering fight or flight right now. So if you're trying to make something look as close to a human as possible, but are just a tiny bit off, everything crumbles. The Goddess of Spring was still good practice for Disney because only 3 years later, they released the world's first fully animated feature film, Snow White. Can you really blame Disney for going 6 times over budget to make this movie? I mean, just look at how these human characters are moving. 10 years before Snow White, animated humans looked like this. So going from this to this in only 10 years? How? I can't get over how real these human characters look sometimes. Almost too real. Well, I think you're old enough to learn about the dangers of rotoscoping is the process of taking real-life footage and then manually tracing over every frame, resulting in an animation with unreal levels of realism. And I say unreal derogatorily. You're basically slapping a cartoon filter over live-action footage, but instead of simply slapping, you're spending multiple hours doing mindless and tedious drawing. Rotoscoping is not the same as filming a human actor and then later referencing that footage, like what Disney did for Sleeping Beauty or Alice in Wonderland or any movie ever, because animators use references all the time. People had figured out how to rotoscope other people long before Snow White. So of course Disney, who was trying to convey real human movement, rotoscoped some shots. The problem with rotoscoping is that we start to sneak our way back to the bottom of the uncanny valley. Animated characters often do and should break the laws of physics. They can squash and stretch into weird proportions and be drawn in unique and interesting poses. And look, Snow White is still a masterpiece of a movie. The rotoscoping is fine, you barely notice it. It's good, it's a good movie, and it made Disney a lot of money. Also, how did Walt animate these shots of things reflecting in the water in 1937? What, did they put special glass over paintings to make it look distorted or something? Who would be crazy enough to do that? If you made a whole movie entirely rotoscoped, what you end up with is Ralph Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings. Notice anything off about these characters' movements? Look at how Gandalf moved just a year ago in The Hobbit. Now, Lord of the Rings. Hobbit. Lord of the Rings. Almost every shot in this movie was rotoscoped, and the shots that weren't used live-action footage with a filter over it. I'm not saying that rotoscoping is bad. You just have to use it correctly. A character switching from traditionally animated to rotoscoped is incredibly funny, and always will be. The YouTuber Joel Havier makes very entertaining rotoscope skits that feel like a fever dream, and I mean that underogatorily. And a lot of music videos get away with rotoscoping because, admittedly, rotoscoping is a very cool visual. Now, I wish I could say the first Lord of the Rings movie was a hidden animation gem, but I don't know, it's not on my top 10, I'm sorry. It probably made a lot of nerds in the 70s happy, but thankfully The Lord of the Rings has been adapted into many other forms of media, like video games, Magic the Gathering cards, and anime.
Anime? They're making a Lord of the Rings anime?
They're making a Lord of the Rings...
You thought Hollywood, California was the only place in the world making moving pictures? Japan's been making their own moving pictures too, and some of them are moving drawings. There are entire college courses on the history of anime, but you're not paying me tuition, so we're gonna have to skip over a couple things. A lot of early anime is now lost media because cinemas didn't preserve film back then, and an earthquake destroyed many studios in 1923. Some Japanese animators created shorts out of paper cutouts because buying thousands of celluloid sheets was too expensive, and they had some very unique character designs. And some Japanese animators took inspiration from Disney and made shorts that looked very similar to America's rubber hose characters. Then, by the 1940s, some major world events happened that got most of the world involved, and both American and Japanese animation studios were affected. But after all that, in 1948, one studio called Japan Animated Films, later bought out by Toei Animation, set out to be the Disney of the East, and they made cartoons about magical schoolgirls, and are still in business to this day and made some other less popular shows. One animator who quit working at Toei created his own company and made an anime based off his comic about a robot boy. Hey, I kinda like that art style of drawing humans with big expressive eyes. Let's do more of that. That same year, another studio made an anime about humans controlling giant robots. I wonder if that's going to inspire a whole new genre. And this guy was commissioned by American studios to make stop-motion Christmas movies like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Meaning Rudolph is anime.
Nani?
By the 1960s, Japanese shows started airing on televisions all across the globe, and they continued to make unique and interesting stories with amazing animations that were beloved by billions of people and grew into extremely profitable franchises. Like, I'm talking the most profitable franchise. By the 1970s, Disney was still very much the animated movie gold standard, making big-budgeted movies with family-friendly values. Which is fine to do, kids love bright colors and talking animals that only cartoons can offer, but some studios realized that animation was a medium, not a genre, and made animated movies exclusively for adults. That's part of the reason why the first Lord of the Rings movie was entirely rotoscoped. It wasn't trying to be cartoony and over the top, it was trying to be real and gritty. Animation could be anything for anyone of any age.
But really, if you think about it, there hadn't been a new way of showing people moving drawings since those very early days of black and white stop motion. In stop motion, you take a picture, move a figure, take a picture, move a figure. In cell animation, you take a picture, move a cell, take a picture, move a cell. Everything's just been a series of pictures moved manually in front of a camera this whole time? Always has been.
You've got mail.
Oh. It says the entire animation and film industry is about to be flipped onto its head forever and ever. Yeah, right. I'm sure this whole computer thing is just... Ever-increasing advancements of technology, we were able to achieve increasingly advanced... achievements, like putting a guy on the moon, and drawing silly little cartoons more efficiently. Gone are the days of having to physically draw everything out on paper and underpay a team of hundreds of pretty girls to hand paint every frame. Now we can use this fancy new computer to render everything out for us. All we have to do is create a real life mold of our real life human hand, then draw 350 triangles onto that hand, then manually measure out the X, Y, and Z coordinates of 800 different data points. No, come on, this is gonna be so much faster. Put that pencil down. Now we just program in a couple of keyframes and we get... Huh. We still don't have the processing power to render everything out. Oh, I know! We'll just point this long exposure camera at the computer screen. Get these art supplies out of here. This is the future. And when everything's finished rendering, we'll get this! A whole human hand moving on its own without having to draw a single frame. This process is exactly what Utah University student Ed Catmull did in 1972. And while it might not have been more efficient than drawing everything out by hand, it showed that computers were capable of rendering out three-dimensional animations. This was made after we landed a man on the moon, by the way, so don't tell me this was CGI. As the computer's processing power grew exponentially, more and more filmmakers started seeing the benefits of using computer-generated images in movies. A decade after Catmull digitized his hand, films like Tron showcased characters racing on mind-boggling computer-generated light cycles. This might look... you know, bad by today's standards, but these graphics were something that audiences had never seen before. Plus, the movie takes place inside of a computer, so this is probably what people thought the insides of a computer looked like anyways. At the time, computers did a great job at creating rigid, geometric shapes, and animators used that to their advantage. Characters would still have to be animated traditionally on cells, but objects that weren't going to change shape, like black cauldrons, could now magically fly in circles around our characters. Disney really showed off the computer's rendering power during the climax of The Great Mouse Detective, when these two rodents fought each other inside a clock tower and all the spinning gears were generated by a computer. Animators can now make any complex shape move in a three-dimensional space without having to draw a single frame. I mean, you know, except for the characters, they still very much had to draw those. Computer graphics were here to stay as Disney integrated more of them into movies like these Cars in Oliver and Company or Eric Ship in The Little Mermaid, and then they stopped using cells entirely. Starting with The Rescuers Down Under, Disney no longer used cells and made movies entirely digitally with a program called CAPS. So if you ever wanted to own a cell of Joanna the Lizard eating an egg, that's too bad because they don't exist. Which fucking sucks because Joanna was the best goddamn lizard Disney ever made. Don't touch me! TV shows and anime still use cells till about the year 2000-ish, but eventually everyone switched to digital. Now to color a frame, all you had to do was... So computers were great at making rigid, non-flexible shapes, but has anyone ever tried to make... A group of computer scientists who were working for a small indie director named George Lucas were taking this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters completely generated by a computer. Then a small entrepreneur named Steve Jobs hired those computer scientists and made his own company, Pixar. Yes, Steve Jobs was one of the founders of Pixar, and he originally created the company to sell a high-end computer powerful enough to render 3D animations. But no one bought the computer because it cost $135,000. So the team scrapped the computer selling idea and just stuck with making computer-generated cartoons. But they soon discovered a unique problem. The computer had a hard time getting textures right, and everything, including babies, ended up looking like it was made out of plastic.
So the team's clever workaround this dilemma was to make a movie with the entire cast of characters actually made out of plastic. Or ants. You know, people don't know what ants are supposed to look like. It's fine. Pixar continued to develop new processes to get the computer to generate unique textures and lighting, like simulating human hair or fur, or lighting things in such a way to make everything appear underwater. No other studio was pioneering computer-generated images like Pixar was. And then in 2006, Disney bought Pixar. But I don't think Steve was too upset because 1 year later, he achieved his dream of selling a high-end computer. This time being a little more affordable. A little. Now, I want to squash any misconception that computers do all the animating. Animators still have to manually pose a character's body and facial expression off of a character's build a complex system of nodes and bones that let them manually pose a character into any position possible. It's kind of like a digital stop-motion puppet, or an actual puppet without any of the strings. All CG characters are just their own complicated version of Pinocchio. Using character rigs is really the only way of animating things in three dimensions. But it's not like we can use rigs in 2D animation. Here in the second dimension, we don't have a fancy Z-axis. 2D animation can only be done by hand-drawing 24 new images every second. Except we don't, I lied. Even all the way back when characters were animated with paper and cells, animators wouldn't draw a whole new frame every frame. Usually, they would animate pieces of a character and paint each piece on its own cell. You remember Robin, they only drew one body and five different heads. But because cells are a physical object that get harder to handle the more you have, animators could only break a character up into two or three different pieces. But now, thanks to the computer, we can break up a character into as many pieces as we'd like four, or five, or 173! Have you ever played around with the free and revolutionary animation software Pivot Stick Figure Animator? If you're the type of person that says, "Oh, I suck at drawing. I can't even draw stick figures," then you're gonna love this program. On Pivot, you're given a pre-made stick figure or horse that have these joints that can be posed however you like. Each of these stick figure's limbs are just individual pieces that are connected in such a way that make it look like a stick figure. So to make these animations, we're not really drawing anything, we're just manually posing out a character like a digital puppeteer. I wasn't saying you can make a rig out of 173 pieces just to be funny. Because that's how many pieces I'm made out of. That's right, me! Even I'm a rig! And can I tell you a secret? Most TV shows use rigs too. Of course, hand-drawn traditional animation is still used to make these shows. It's not a lost art form or anything. But rigs are super useful at making still pretty high-quality levels of animation, but at a much cheaper cost. And as we all know, TV animation has to create more animation per budget. But maybe rig animation still isn't as cost-effective as you'd like. And maybe you're not a fan of the complicated puppet look, and you want something that looks more human. Well, there's one more animation process we can try, called motion. An actor inside one of these dorky ping-pong suits, a computer can pinpoint and record that actor's exact movements. Now we can take those movements, slap a cartoon character's model over it, and we get an animation that looks like... shit. Motion capture is the rotoscoping of 3D animation. It cuts costs, but the results are too human, and we're back at the bottom of the uncanny valley. That's why the kids from the Polar Express look so nightmarish, because they are following the exact movements of Tom Hanks. Yes, Tom Hanks, the adult man, did some motion capture for the small, nameless hero boy from the Polar Express. There's probably a reason we haven't made a fully motion capture cartoon in over 10 years. Because it looks weird. But I mean, that didn't stop one of these movies from winning an Oscar in animation. And before you ask, no, it wasn't Monster House or Tintin. It was Mars Needs Moms. Duh. Just like rotoscoping, motion capture can be used correctly. Computer-generated characters acting side-by-side real human actors look decent. It's not that jarring that these creatures who exist in a live-action world are moving just like live-action people. And let's not forget all the VTubers who use motion capture technology to bring their jiggly assets to life. No matter what method someone uses to try and convince you that something else is alive, I think is incredibly cool. And I hope you think it's cool too. But maybe you don't think it's cool, and you don't care about animation, and you just put this video on in the background while you were cleaning. That's totally fine. I do that all the time. I just like learning about how all of my favorite animated pieces of media get created, because it's not always the same process. And I think it's great that new technology is allowing anyone to express themselves in whatever way possible. A person expressing themselves. Those are the three key words here. From the big studios that are just now pioneering new and interesting styles with digital animation, to the indie studios that have access to incredible technology which allow anyone working from their bedrooms in their pajamas to create some truly masterpieces of animation. So, if you're the type of person that likes to trick people into thinking that something is alive, then you deserve all the respect in the world. In fact, here are some cool people that made the animation in this video possible. Hello, you just made it to the end of this video. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm still trying to figure out this VTuber model, so I'm over-enunciating my words. The technology behind this is beyond my comprehension. If you're still deciding what to get for the holidays, then great news. We have mystery boxes over on my website, so you can leave the deciding up to us. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm gonna go take a nap. Are you still watching? Oh yeah, she's coming back.
Welcome to the Warrior Cat Wing of the Animation History Museum. I will be guiding your tour today. I hope you have nothing else planned. Warrior Cats is a book series that follows a society of feral cats who live in these groups that are kind of a mix between a gang and a cult. While they are considered kids' books, I will say Warrior Cats is less fun time happy cat adventures and more Watership Down. We won't be getting too graphic here, but a lot of the cats don't make it. Now you might be wondering why these books have their own dedicated wing in the Animation History Museum. These are letters, not pictures, stupid. Well, you see, this fan base has the most animated fan base ever. Yes, even more than that one you really like. People love to draw these cats. Coming up is one of my favorite pieces. The artist's use of anime hair and Windows Movie Maker transitions perfectly encapsulates that indescribable era of 2009. And I especially love the artist's bold choice of including their OC into this piece, really calling to the essence of the human experience and that desire to rescue a villain who is also your comfort character. Something you need to understand is that kids who are now adults have been drawing these cats for quite some time. We have records of kids drawing these cats all the way back in 2004. And if you were a Warrior Cat fan during the 2008 housing market crash, then you were eating extremely well, not with food, but with edgy cat animations drawn entirely by a mouse. Fans were making anime openings, AMVs, and graphic depictions of some of the more Watership Down moments in the series. I'm blurring these out because mutilated cats bum me out. And just like the books that are still coming out, the Warriors never stopped drawing. I don't want to sound dramatic, but you could spend the rest of your life watching nothing but Warrior Cat fan animations and still not have seen them all. I actually haven't done the math on that yet, but trust me, there's a lot. Is this playlist still going? I have been fully aware of the vast quantity of Warrior Cat fan animations for quite some time. Heck, I've even hired some of them. But I've never been able to truly enjoy a Warrior Cat fan animation, as I've never read these books growing up, because all the kids in my class who did pretended to be the cats during recess and would hiss at me whenever I tried talking to them, which even back then I was like, okay, this is a little weird, guys. But I regret not reading these books growing up, because now I'm left with all these unanswered questions. Why are so many people drawn to drawing these fictional cats? What are these feelings stirring in my bosom as I watch these? And why do the art styles change so much?
As we move down the Warrior Cat fan animation timeline, around 2012 is when the Warriors really begin to specialize in multi-animator projects. Basically, there were so many people willing to draw these cats that a large group of them all worked together, each animating a different segment of a video, and then when everyone's segment gets done in 14 months, the finished segments get stitched together into one complete video. I guarantee you've seen at least one of these group reanimator projects before, and you might have the Warriors to thank for that. I don't know who started the trend. Maps work out great for everyone, because now you and 40 of your animation buddies only have to animate a few seconds of a cat fight, and we get to watch a super engaging music video with changing art styles every 6 seconds. I really have to commend everyone who puts these projects together, especially the ones that were done before messaging apps like Discord even existed. But what I find extremely impressive is that everyone who signs up for these projects are doing so simply for exposure. No one involved expects any type of monetary compensation, and Warrior maps are very often made to copyrighted music, meaning no one's making money off these projects anyways. I can only imagine what musicians must go through when their manager tells them, "You're not gonna believe this! Someone just made a fan-animated music video of your song on YouTube!" And then the artist goes to watch it, and they just see a bunch of cartoon cats fighting each other. Violently. Can I tell you a quick story time? Once I wandered into a Barnes & Noble and thought, I wonder if they have any physical copies of Warrior Cats, because that is something I am willing to buy. So I went to the young adult section, looked under W, and found nothing. They didn't have any. Well, that's too bad, I thought. I mean, between the main books, graphic novels, and super editions, there's only over 100 different books, with new ones still being written to this day, but I guess this BNN doesn't have any. Oh well. But then, I had the disturbing realization that I might be looking in the wrong place. I was looking in the young adult section. I needed to extend my search to the kids corner, spelled with a Z. So, I gingerly walked from the kid book section to the little kid book section, trying to find the book I was currently reading. And there, next to the barn built into the wall and the blocks, were the Warriors. I'm not going to judge you on whatever books you like to read, because I live in a glass house. If I was ever going to understand what made people so drawn to drawing these violent feral kitty cats, then I would have to start reading these. So, whether you never read these books but are curious to know why so many people are drawing the characters, or maybe you did read these books a long time ago and want a refresher from the perspective of an adult who didn't grow up with them. Either way, get your favorite cat treat and knock something off a counter as we dive paws first into the wild and wonderful world of Warrior Cats. So, spoiler warning for Warrior Cats. Our main protagonist is Rusty, a handsome ginger Tom. Those are not my words. That is how he's described in the character description at the front of the book. Ignore that he's called Firepaw right now. Firepaw and Rusty are the same cat. It'll make sense in a little bit. Rusty is a regular house cat living with people, or as he would call them, two legs. You see, cats have some pretty unique slurs for everyday normal human things. This isn't a car driving on a road. It's a monster on the Thunderpath. Personally, I love it when books explain everyday mundane human things from, like, a non-human perspective. Like, yeah, a car would be a monster to a cat. It merges without using a turn signal. Now, our main cat, Rusty, grows tired of his soft kitty pet life and thinks maybe living in the forest directly behind his backyard would sorta kinda be cool. But he's not ready for a big life change just yet. But then one day, Rusty's only friend in the entire world named Smudge, he tells Rusty, "Hey, did you know when our owners take us to the vet, they chop our guys off?" Fellas, would you spend the rest of your life surviving in the woods if it meant you gotta keep both of your dudes? I would. So, like many other unneutered male cats, Rusty abandons his soft kitty pet life and sets out to start a new, wild and free life in the forest directly behind his backyard. It turns out there's a whole society of wild feral kitty cats living in the forest behind Rusty's backyard.
and they've divided themselves into four distinct groups, or clans. The first clan we're going to be looking at is Thunder Clan. This is the clan our protagonists belong to and where most of the story takes place. These cats are the moral, compassionate, brave ones. Gryffindor. The next clan is Shadow Clan. These are the edgy, evil cats. Slytherin. Sure, there's evil cats in every clan, but a lot of them are from Shadow Clan, especially in Season 1. Because they have Shadow in the name, I always imagined every cat here was just a black Halloween cat. The next clan is River Clan. Their main thing is... they swim. I wouldn't call them Ravenclaw because they're not smart. They're more of a water tribe. And the next clan is Wind Clan, but you don't need to worry, they're Hufflepuffs, so. Cats from different clans hate each other and are super territorial. Don't even think about falling in love and starting a family with a cat from a different clan. That is so unaccepted, it happens constantly. And those are the four clans in the forest. However, there's one clan not in the forest we need to talk about called... Star Clan. Ooh. Did you know cats have their own religion? Your childhood cat isn't going to be kicking it with you in boring old two-leg heaven. They're going to be sharing tongues with their ancestors in Star Clan. Sharing tongues is like when cats lick each other, like, you know, normal cat behavior. But whenever I read sharing tongues, I always thought they were like French kissing or something. Star Clan is basically warrior cat heaven. And it's so much more than a character looking up at the night sky and seeing their deceased dad in the clouds. Instead, Star Clan plays a much bigger role in the books, and we get to frequently visit and see what wacky antics the cat angels get up to. So even though there is a lot of death in warrior cats, just because a cat dies doesn't mean it's the last we'll ever see of them. They'll just be in their angel form from now on. And those are the five clans you need to know about. It's just those four main ones and warrior cat heaven. There's not going to be, like, a secret sixth clan or anything. Now, normally, forest cats are super big on cat purity and would never allow this random outsider into their clan. But you see, the leader of Thunder Clan, named Blue Star, she had a pretty good reason to allow this handsome Ginger Tom into the clan. Blue Star, you know, kind of thought he was the chosen one. And he canonically still had both of his guys, so. Prophecies play a very big role in the wild world of warrior cats. And the first prophecy we hear about is, fire alone will save the clan. So knowing that fire alone will save the clan, Blue Star sees this handsome Ginger Tom just wandering through the forest and officially accepts him into Thunder Clan, bestowing him the new name, Fire Paw. See, that's why the front of the book called him Fire Paw, remember? Now it's making sense. So completely remove the name Rusty from your brain. That's never coming back. Everyone who's read these books knows this cat as Fire Paw. He's got a paw of fire. By this point, you've probably noticed a pretty unique formula to some of these cat names. Blue Star? Fire Paw? Let's take a look at some of these other characters, shall we? Let's see, we got Ashfur, Mousefur, Leopardfur, Frostfur, Russetfur, Oak fur? Bracken fur? Soot fur? Ash fur again? Okay, what the fur is going on? What's with all these war- If you are not privy to the naming convention of these warrior cat characters, the nomenclature of these cat names follows a simple two-part system. Every cat's name is made up of any of these prefixes and any of these suffixes. Can you see that? Graypaw, White Storm, Blue Star. Every name is like this. Mountain Dew is a valid warrior cat name. Now, I already knew about these ridiculous double syllable names going into the series, and I was legitimately worried it would be impossible for me to keep track and remember all of these cat names. But do you want to know something I didn't know going into this series? Their name changes. When I got to the first name-changing ceremony, I threw the book down thinking, I'm not smart enough to understand the complexities of warrior cats. I should just give up. But then I thought, no. If a 9-year-old child in 2008 can remember all these ridiculous cat names, then so can I. And then I got to one of the many kit birthing scenes, and all the cats would go, "Oh boy, more warriors for ThunderClan! Everyone welcome Ice Kit and Fox Kit!" And I would go,
I hope Ice Kid and Fox Kid die.
But I must say, once you really get into this series, remembering all the different cat names isn't that big of an issue. First of all, sometimes the cat's name will just be a short description of what they physically look like, ergo make them easier to remember. What do you think Running Nose looks like? What do you think Spider Legs looks like? I don't know what Mouse Fur looks like, but in my head, she's always wearing like a mouse costume. And just everyone, no one addresses it. They're just like, that's mouse fur. What's really bad is that there's like mouse fur and then mouse kit, like in the same scene. And it's like, what are we doing here, Aaron? And as strange as these names sound, there's actually a methodology to them that correlates to what rank a cat is. Kittens will always have the suffix kit. You read the sentence, Ice Kit and Fox Kit were playing in the hollow. You don't have to worry about them. They don't matter. Apprentices will always have the suffix paw, because they're apprentices. Fire paw and gray paw are both apprentices. And anything above them is when the warrior names get a little more creative and don't have a set suffix, except for the very top, the leaders, which always have the name star. Which means you have to be careful reading the wiki, because sometimes learning a cat's up-to-date name is a spoiler. Now instead of having to remember Gray Stripe, Blue Star, White Storm, all you really have to remember is Gray, Blue, White. And while we're looking at the clan hierarchy, can I just talk about medicine cats real quick? Medicine cats are responsible for healing the sick and injured clanmates, and they don't use, like, medicine. All of their healing comes from herbs found locally in the forest, but I always felt like the books were stretching some of the healing properties they claimed these herbs possessed. Okay, the cats are constantly getting into fights, so they're getting scratches, and the med cats would put cobwebs over wounds. Okay, I can sort of see that working as like a natural band-aid. But then, during one of the many kit birthing scenes, the med cats would be like, "Oh no! Give her a poppy seed to calm her down!" And I was always like, a singular poppy seed? Like, from a bagel? At least give her, like, a couple.
So back in the forest, Rusty meets all the other apprentices in ThunderClan. And one apprentice confides in our hero some terrible news. He secretly witnessed this other cat named Tigerclaw murder another cat in his own clan.
Tigerclaw is here, and he murdered the cat here. The deputy, because deputies of a clan are next in line to be leader, so he couldn't just murder the leader, he has to murder the deputy so he could be deputy, and then he can murder the leader. Do you understand? Good. Okay, cool.
I just want to point out that I got this corkboard off Facebook Marketplace, and the pictures did not show how badly sun-damaged it was.
So immediately, this series sets up Tigerclaw as the main bad guy of the story. That he's willing to murder cats in his own clan to become leader. And getting to become the leader of a clan is a very enticing idea to Tigerclaw, because leaders get blessed by StarClan with 9 lives. Every other cat only gets 1 life, but the leaders get to die 8 extra times.
And I really like this plot device, because as the series goes on, we get to keep track of how many times a leader loses a life, and the suspense builds and builds as we get closer to that final one. Now, our heroes kinda do everything in their power not to tell anyone that Tigerclaw is the bad guy. Like, there's seriously a scene where Firepaw gets a one-on-one training session with Blue Star, and he's like, "I should probably tell the leader of my clan about the broad-shoulder backstabbing murderer named Tigerclaw in the clan." But then Blue Star's like, "Fight me!" And then he gets caught up in the fighting, and then he just forgets to tell her. Okay. So just like the other characters, we're gonna keep the thought of Tigerclaw being the main bad guy in the back of our mind, because we got more important stuff to worry about. ShadowClan just attacked ThunderClan for no reason. Oh, fuck!
And they end up killing Firepaw's secret crush, who he barely talked to and was way older than him and practiced celibacy.
The Thundercats and Shadowcats face off in a big epic battle, and eventually the heroic Thundercats defeat the evil Shadowcats.
And as the first episode comes to a close, Blue Star promotes Firepaw to the warrior class. Firepaw's new warrior name is Fireheart. Alright, that's now two times our protagonist has changed names in one book.
Now that Fireheart is officially a warrior, I would like to take a quick palate-cleansing break from the wild world of warrior cats, because I would feel extremely remiss if I didn't share with you all a rather humorous story time about an instance where I, too, was trying to become a warrior. So when I was deep into reading these books, I went to this boxing gym because I was training for nothing, apparently. And on my drive to said boxing gym, I would listen to the Warriors. It helped me get into the right headspace, I guess. Now, the way the parking lot at this gym worked was that sometimes you'd park your car in front of another car, and then you would give your keys to the receptionist guy at the front, and he would move your car for you. Totally fine, totally cool, except for the one time I made the mistake of leaving my phone in the car, a phone that would auto-connect and immediately play the last thing I was listening to if said car were to turn on. At any given moment, I'd like to think my social interaction skills are at a 7 out of 10. Pretty good, but still room for improvement. In the middle of a boxing class, I'm covered in sweat, I got stink lines coming off me, now I'm at a 6 out of 10. But when the boxing gym receptionist comes up to me and says, "Hey man, you left your phone in your car. By the way, love the book you're reading." Whoosh! Now I'm at a 0. I've talked to this receptionist before, and he knew I did YouTube, so I tried desperately to explain myself. "Oh, you know, I'm going to make a video about it. Plus, I wanted to read more this year." And then he asks, "Are you going to mention
the movie?"
I was cut off by this. I knew there wasn't a Warrior Cats movie, but I was absolutely not going to argue about it with the boxing gym receptionist in front of a bunch of dudes punching each other. So I just went, "There's a movie?" And he goes, "Yeah, there's a movie." And the way he said, "Yeah, there's a movie," made it sound like I was the dumb one for not knowing about the Warrior Cats movie. And I forget exactly what I said after that, but it was probably along the lines of, "Could someone please punch me so I no longer have to be in this conversation?" And for the whole rest of the class, I could not fathom why that guy was so positive about the existence of a movie that definitely didn't exist. Did he see someone reenact the entire book with Littlest Pet Shop Dolls and think that was a movie?
I'm sure gonna miss you, Ravenpaw.
Why don't we share tongues one last time?
It wasn't until I got back to my car when things started to click. When I turned my car on and connected my phone, the little dashboard screen thingy didn't say, "Now playing Warriors, The New Prophecy, Episode 5. All it said was, "Now playing Twilight." So he thinks I was reading that, and I don't know which is worse.
So diving paws first back into the wild world of warrior cats, Fireheart's best bro for life, who is now named Graystripe, starts being a little horn cat. It's like horn dog, but it's a horn cat. He's being a little frisky boy.
You see, it all started when Graystripe accidentally fell into a river and was rescued by a cat in River Clan. And these two cats from different clans immediately hit it off. But this will just be the first example of one of the many universal truths about warrior cats. All it takes for two characters to fall deeply in love with each other is if they ever appear in a scene together. And that's especially true for cats from different clans. Something about betraying your whole clan is sexy, I guess. Meow.
Fireheart keeps his best bro's forbidden relationship a secret when all of a sudden, she's pregnant? And she's having the kids now? Graystripe's gonna be a dad? Graystripe's girlfriend doesn't make it through kit birth, but luckily, her kids do. We have the boy one and the girl one. You don't have to worry about them ever again. This leaf blower is killing me. What do I do? What do I do about this leaf blower? Do I ask him to stop?
After this scene, Graystripe's forbidden relationship made a lot more sense to me. It felt rushed and contrived because this was never a love story. It was an I got the River Clan leader's daughter pregnant who then died in kit birth story. A classic tale for all children's books. This death was the first in the series that made me go, whoa, warrior cats don't mess around. Who kills off the pregnant girlfriend? And then Graystripe tries living in River Clan for a bit, but that ultimately falls through, so he doesn't get to live there anymore, and he never gets to see his two kids grow up. Well, his first two kids.
While Graystripe was going behind everyone's back to visit his River Clan girlfriend, Fireheart was going behind everyone's back to visit his biological sister at her two-legs nest. And she tells him, you know, you're making the idea of living in the forest sound totally cool and awesome. I don't want to completely uproot my life, though, so could you take one of my kids away and force him to live with you?
This is Cloudtail, Fireheart's sister's son. The books never call this white cat Fireheart's nephew. They always called him his sister's kit, sister's son, or sister's firstborn.
Now, this could just be because cats are quirky with words and don't have a name to describe the relationship of your sister's son. But the more the books kept avoiding ever using the word nephew, the more I started to worry that nephew was too big of a word for this reading level. But then the books throw the word jubilant at you? You're not going to use nephew, but jubilant's fine? You seriously going to make me pull out a dictionary, warrior cat?
Since Cloudtail was thrown into clan life kind of against his will, he doesn't super respect the strict set of rules all the clan cats follow.
And he's an atheist. Just doesn't believe in Star Clan, like, at all. That detail never really comes up, but the books let you know that he is one. It's super important that you know the religious views of these cats, okay?
Cloudtail ends up getting captured by Two Legs, and now it's up to his mother's brother to rescue him. When this scene was first introduced, I got super excited because by now, so much of the drama in this series has been cats fighting over prey, cats fighting over territory, and cats fighting over love. So when the opportunity of a rescue my sister's son heist was introduced, I was excited just for something different. Fireheart's going to have to navigate through a two-leg nest he's never been in before and describe all the mundane human things he sees from his non-human cat perspective. What is this strange hissing elephant? I love it when books do that kind of stuff.
But while I was thinking of all the interesting possibilities, Fireheart just opens the front door and Cloudtail escapes. He never even goes inside. Cool. Glad you're back, Cloudtail. You're going to follow the strict set of rules, but still be an atheist? No, that's fine. Yeah, I think I saw some fresh kill we could hunt back there.
Once our heroes were finally done dealing with their atheist nephew and pregnant girlfriend, they finally came to their senses and told the leader Blue Star about the murderous broad-shouldered Tiger Claw in the clan.
And it actually got to a point where I started to question if Tiger Claw really was the main bad guy.
Now, this might just be because I watch too many movies, but when something tries this hard to tell me he's the main bad guy, especially this early on in the story, I start to think, yeah, I can smell this plot twist coming from a mile away.
Fireheart never had any proof Tiger Claw was evil. He was just blindly believing what this other random apprentice was saying.
Tiger Claw was there when Cinderpelt got her legs run over, but we don't know for sure he caused the accident. How does a cat even orchestrate something like that?
Yeah, he might be constantly giving off bad vibes, but that's just all part of the misdirection. I'm telling ya, there's enough wiggle room here for this cat to actually be the misunderstood good guy.
But it turns out, no. He is evil and he did all those evil things.
Tiger Claw, what is this? Blue Star's meow was sharper now, edged with anger, not fear. I'm the leader of your clan.
I'm the leader of your clan.
Or have you forgotten that?
Not for much longer, Tiger Claw growled. I'm going to kill you, and kill you again, as many times as it takes for you to join Star Clan forever.
It wasn't until I read that exact line when I started to think, okay, Tiger Claw is for sure the main bad guy. I thought it was ambiguous this whole time. But no, he's the bad guy. He's bad.
So the villain of the story turned out to be a character I wasn't expecting to be the villain, making Tiger Claw, at least for me, an untwisted twist villain.
So Tiger Claw is exiled from the camp, and since Blue Star no longer trusts anyone else in the camp, except for Fireheart, she promotes him to clan deputy. Meaning, at the start of the series, Fireheart was here, below everyone in the clan, and by the end of episode 3, he's already here, second in command, next in line to be leader.
But the cherry on top, this terrible news cake, is that our main bad guy, Tiger Claw, isn't done doing main bad guy things. Shadow Clan just made some pretty significant changes to the clan hierarchy.
Our main bad guy, Tiger Claw, who was the biggest proponent of cat purity, by the way, switches teams and becomes the new leader of Shadow Clan.
He finally got his wish of becoming leader and getting 9 lives. We're dealing with Tiger Star now. Then Tiger Star sets a pack of wild dogs loose in the ThunderClan camp, and they end up killing random background characters.
It's one of those wild feral dogs that kill cats and tear off faces. Oh, it's so the horror. I'm getting attacked by a dog. Ah! Oh, wait, I'm wearing makeup. Maybe you should.
The dogs chase Fireheart off a cliff and into some rushing water, and right as the light begins to fade from his eyes, Blue Star swoops in and rescues him.
But I guess that used up the last of her energy because, in a horrible twist of fate, she's now dying. And it's her last life, by the way. I've been keeping track.
This one's for you, Blue Star.
Okay, so, she's out of the picture. Fireheart, the current clan deputy, becomes the new leader of Thunder Clan, which also means he's going to change names.
His new name is Firestar. All right? It's not Fireheart or Firepaw, and it's certainly not Rusty. This is Firestar. This will be the last time that he changes names. It's physically impossible for him to change names again.
Unfortunately, this moment was spoiled for me. I always knew that Rusty would be the leader of Thunder Clan because while I was researching this video, I remembered this classic fan animation I saw ages ago about Fireheart not liking waffles.
Oh, waffle time, it's waffle time. Will you have some waffles of mine?
So I watched this video again for entirely research purposes and was horrified to see the video was actually called Firestar Doesn't Like Waffles. This video was a pretty big spoiler for me. So Tiger Star and Firestar are now both topped to the nines new lives. If we're ever going to defeat Tiger Star, he's going to have to be eliminated 9 times. Voldemort only needed 8 times. It's going to be a race of cat and cat to see who will be the last cat to lose their final life. And with the amount of books that are still in this series, I could see their rivalry lasting a really, really long time. Until this series goes in a direction that I think I should mention spoiler warning again, because wow. If you're at all familiar with this story and know what's about to happen, I bet you've just been dying for me to get to this part. To help accomplish his destroy Firestar by any means necessary plan, Tiger Star teams up with Blood Clan? Here's my mood board for the secret 6th clan that's been here this whole time. These are the extremely tough city cats. They live in the city that we've never heard of before. They don't have strange double-syllable names or believe in a star clan, but they still call themselves a clan and have a clan leader for some reason. The leader of Blood Clan is Tiny. He's this tiny little black cat that wears a dog teeth collar, and he's a fan favorite. That's what all of this has been building up. You see? Scourge, Scourge, Scourge. I'm Scourge. I already pointed at myself. I know I've been doing a lot of Harry Potter references throughout this video, but I don't think there's a single Harry Potter character that best encompasses who this cat is. I think the best fictional character I could make a comparison to is Shadow the Hedgehog. So how are they going to fight two evil clans that formed an alliance? Well, the thing is, tiny little Scourge betrays Tiger Star and murders him in front of everyone. But that's okay. He's got 9 lives, remember? Wait, what's happening? Again, the massive tabby's body grew still for a heartbeat. But again, the wound was too terrible to yield to the healing trance. His claws tore up clumps of grass in his agony, while his screeches turned from fury to terror. This is a kid's book. He's dying 9 times! Holy sh**, said Firestar. Tiny little Scourge kills Tiger Star so badly that he dies, resurrects, and then dies again 9 times. So the villain of the story turned out to be a character I wasn't expecting to be the villain. They got me twice! Initially, I was in denial. No, Tiger Star canonically had 9 lives. He can't die instantly to a cat we just met. This scene had me so flabbergasted that I had to reach out to someone. And everyone I talked to about it was always like, oh, you mean Scourge? I love Scourge. Scourge is so cool. And then I thought, okay, if this cat is so beloved, I should at least give him a chance. Maybe this whole time, the books were actually setting up how evil and ruthless this Scourge guy is. You thought that cat was the main bad guy? This new guy just killed him with barely any effort. This also sets up that Firestar's brand new 9 lives are essentially worthless because this new cat can just kill you and have you instantly burn through all 9 of them. Well, not instantly. Slow and painfully. Which is definitely worse.
Alright. It's a little unconventional, but if this is how the series sets up the actual main bad guy, then let's do it. Scourge, you've won me over.
When Scourge and Firestar face off for control over the whole forest, Scourge very easily kills Firestar, because of course he does. Firestar is just a random kitty pet who stumbled his way up the clan hierarchy. And this is Scourge. Ultimate life form Scourge.
Firestar
dies. Except this time, when Scourge kills a clan leader, he only loses once. 1 life. He only dies once. Because of the power of friendship or something. I think it's a metaphor for Jesus, actually, and I'm not making that up. Unlike Tiger Star, Firestar successfully, I'm sorry, fellas, I'm keeping you away from your, like, friends and family. Firestar successfully resurrects, and Scourge is very understandably caught off guard by this, because he's never seen a cat do that before. So this time when they face off, it goes a little like this. And that's how season 1 of Warrior Cats ends. As you know, we frequently get to visit and see what wacky antics the cat angels get up to in cat heaven. And while Tiger Star's ghost makes a pretty prevalent comeback, basically becoming the new cat Satan, we never get to see Scourge or his spiky collar ever again. How is a cat who only shows up in this much of the story, kills the main bad guy, and then leaves and never comes back this beloved? It's because he's the ultimate life form, baby. If the only knowledge of warrior cats you have is from what I've told you in this video, while you do know more than the average person about warrior cats, you're still probably not going to understand what most of these fan animations are really about, because we only looked at 6 books out of like 100, and you don't know what the characters actually look like. I've just been showing you Garfield characters. However, my dear viewer, I really wanted to get the full Warrior Cat experience. So I read season 4. This is 4. Shit. I've read season 2, season 3, and season 4. Really just trying to get the full Warrior Cat experience. Season 4 seemed like a good stopping point. I also forgot to mention, I read the Super Editions too. There's like 27 books. I've read 27 books this year. get on my level. I didn't want to do all of them. I'm not crazy, okay? I'm in a padded room. I'm not crazy. So, with me as your local Warrior Cat expert, I can safely say I still have no clue what most of these fan animations are about. It's not my fault that I don't understand these. Most of the things that these people are animating aren't even canon. They've just been animating fan fiction this whole time. Cleopatra takes a character who's not even that prevalent and imagines her as an Egyptian sphinx cat who has, like, no ties to Egypt at all in the books. Next up forever, what if Firestar and Scourge switched lives and Firestar was the one with the spiky collar? Holyphon, all right, this one's got a giant snake monster in it. Mr. Fear asks the question, what if there was a zombie outbreak in Warrior Cats? Scavengers of the Wind, this one's also got a zombie theme going on and is genuinely the most terrifying Warrior Cat animation I've ever seen. I was legit watching this on my TV and I had to turn it off halfway through because it was so terrifying. I don't want to talk about it anymore. It took me reading almost 30 books to finally understand that Warrior Cat fan animations aren't meant to be understood. It seems like people just like drawing cats. But why is that?
Now, I actually have 5 different reasons why I think people are so drawn to drawing these cats. And the first reason is because cats are just fun to draw. Think about it this way. Would you rather spend years studying human anatomy, toiling away for hours trying to get the fingers right, or would you rather just draw a dumb little cat with a new woo face? Reason number 2 is the expansive world. This is the official Warrior Cats family tree. There's quite a few characters that I skipped over. I once heard someone describe Warrior Cats as Game of Thrones for kids, and while I've never seen or read any Game of Thrones, I totally agree with that sentiment. It's even got the incest and everything. Since there are so many characters and little mini-adventures, it's very easy for someone to have a favorite character or moment that they can connect with, regardless of how prevalent they are in the story. And the third reason I think people are so drawn to drawing these cats is the lack of official art at the time. These days, Warrior Cat fans have official graphic novels that they get to look at, and I do own them, but I keep lending them out to people, so that's my bad. But in the early 2010s, all fans had to go off of were words and their imaginations, which I think made people more inclined to draw out their favorite moments in the series, regardless of how graphic and gory they were. In fact, the kids really like drawing the graphic and gory stuff. That's a conversation for another time. The fourth reason I think people like drawing these cats is how this series is perfectly set up to be a fandom. Is that what it says? Perfectly. That's hilarious. Creating your own Warrior Cat OC with a tragic backstory and a unique double-syllable name is not only very easy to do, but it's actually encouraged by the books themselves. At the back of some of these books is this, like, fully plotted out Warrior Cat D&D campaign inviting readers to pretend to be the cats. I always thought the kids during recess who pretended to be the cats were just very devoted fans, but they were just following the instructions the books clearly laid out for them. And the last reason I think people like drawing these cats is because their passion is infectious. I highly recommend you go down the same Warrior Cat fan animation rabbit hole that I did, because what you'll find is thousands of dedicated fans all creating art of their favorite book series. And they're not doing it for money or for views, but because they're passionate. And there's also, like, a bunch of videos that are over 15 years old, and that just makes me nostalgic for that early era of YouTube. I went into this video trying to understand what it was about this series that made people want to draw the cats. But the funny thing is, I ended up drawing these cats too. It's a virus. These cats are so drawable. I initially got my start online creating webcomics. It's something I enjoy doing. I love thinking of a joke, doodling it out, and sharing it with the world. That's my passion. And I guess seeing all of these passionate artists creating these fan animations looked like a whole lot of fun. And the fact that the main character is a ginger male cat, come on, that's just too perfect of an opportunity to do a Garfield reference. I don't think anyone's ever done that before. So me and my team created 40 Garfield-inspired Warrior Cat webcomics, and we posted them every Wednesday. And even though we didn't make any money off of them, I really enjoyed making them and posting them every Wednesday. And not to get too vulnerable here, I know these are just Garfield comics, but they really helped me find my passion in creating art again. So thank you all for reading them. I hope you enjoyed. So if you're someone that's missing a little passion in your life, try watching hours of Warrior Cat fan animations. They're a whole ton of fun to watch. They do get a little violent at times, so, you know, be aware of that. And if you're someone that's ever produced a Warrior Cat fan animation, thank you for inspiring others to follow their passions. And if anyone on the Aaron Hunter team is watching, I hope you know you've made a lot of kids furries. That's all I'll say about that. Thank you all for watching. Have a good night, and I'll see you next time.
Thank you all for joining me in this deep dive into the wild world of Warrior Cats. I know this is a pretty different video than I usually post. I had my face in it for a lot more than I usually do, but this video still took a long time to make because I read all of these books, and there was a period of time where I thought I could talk about all 4 seasons of Warrior Cats, but then the script was just way too long, and I thought season 1 was good enough on its own to be its own dedicated video. If you like this video, let me know, and I can do more Warrior Cat videos. Thank you all for watching, I hope you enjoyed, and wear your seatbelt.